Podcast 8.3. This podcast is also brought to you by Michael Bay, so expect it to explode about halfway through. Explode again. Explode several more times. And then keep exploding all the way through. Can I call you Ann Ace Bender now? Because that guy came up to us during the podcast Live at Moe's on Fridays, and he said that your last name was Ace Bender.
Yes, he did.
And I was like, that's better, honestly.
I prefer Ace Bender.
Ace Bender?
Yeah, as opposed, yeah.
Sort of
Let's
like
go with that.
Yo-Yo Ma, except for hipsterness in blogging.
Apparently, yes.
That's Ace Ann Bender, or Ann Ace Bender, or Ace Bender, whichever nom de plume you
or
prefer.
Old shared
or old shared nipples. We had another one for you too, didn't we?
You know, if it's lost to history, I think I'm okay with that.
Michigan beats Colorado 45-28 in a game that was
a little hairy there.
You know, they're driving to go up 28-7, and I don't get any reception on my phone, and I'm like, oh, thank God I don't get any reception on my phone.
Yeah, you dodged a bullet.
Because then I feel like obliged to say something. Nothing I was going to say there was.
Got to be good.
No.
I had two group chats that were texting back and forth that were like long-standing ones, so
yeah.
Can't just bail out of those. And I figured out how to mute them because it was just a tire fire early on. And then I went and checked back in at halftime, and I had like 64 unread text messages. And it was a good decision to mute.
So a very strange game where Michigan starts off and their defense just gets shredded for an entire quarter. And then after that, nothing bad happened to them except one very bad thing, and then they just crushed Colorado the rest of the way.
Yes.
There were special teams all over the place.
Yes, there were for the second straight week.
Didn't really do anything. I think we should actually lead with the special teams. That's how special teams this game was. So, good Lord. give me that stat that you just told me about Peppers.
All right, so Michigan started drives at Colorado's 38, 37, 45, and 45 again, all set up by Pepper's returns, three punts and one kickoff. And that obviously does not include him starting a drive at the Colorado zero because he returned it all the way.
Right.
So, he flipped field position quite a bit in this game.
Yeah, so sort of reminiscent of the Michigan State game there where the overall yardage is a little bit deceiving just because Michigan didn't have opportunities to drive the field that often.
No, when Peppers is routinely getting it into Colorado territory on his own.
So
this doesn't need to do too much.
And then the other thing that kind of stood out to me is at some point in the game, Peppers, I don't know if he was injured or his helmet came off and he couldn't return a punt. So they sent Darbo out there.
And Darbo lets it bounce.
He does. And then Peppers lets the next one bounce. And I was like, come on. But the sheer lack of bouncing punts in the Peppers punt return era is, I think, another source of hidden yardage where you just don't see those kind of like 70-yard bombs where they get 20 of it on the ground.
Yeah.
Everything is fielded, almost everything. And, you know, we've seen – I watch a lot of college football, and that is not a trait that everybody has.
No. And also his ability to just – I mean, because he like grinds out yards after contact on these punt returns. He's – pretty reliable for making the first three guys miss without even seeming to make much effort about it. And that lets Michigan just go after these punts too. Like they can threaten the punt block and set up a return at the same time, which is quite a luxury.
And speaking of punt blocks, they do block the that punt that they actually got all of this time instead of just a deflection.
Yeah, and they also had, I think they outnumbered the shield. They got a lot of guys through on
they
that
did
one.
They outnumbered. I
didn't know who blocked the punt at first.
The official box score gave it to Jose.
And he did get it.
Yeah.
I have seen the replay of that.
But if it wasn't him, it was going to be Delano Hill.
Yeah.
And they were assisted on that punt block by the fact that one of the up men decided that he was going to block somebody else after deciding to block. Don't never change your mind.
Yeah.
He changed his mind.
This applies to blocking on punts as well as offense.
Same as the rules of blocking number three. Never change your mind. He changed his mind. And that let two guys through, but either way, I think if he does his job, there's still somebody there who's taking the punt off that dude's foot.
Yeah, I mean, they straight up outnumbered the guys in the shield. They were going to get somebody in free no matter what.
Yeah, and that was very strange to me because Colorado's spread punt was more spread than it usually is. Usually there's like a couple of guys, they don't line up next to the center, but they're sort of in
and
the vicinity.
They had huge gaps around the center.
Yeah, and you can chip those guys, right? You can just kind of like knock one guy off and delay him long enough. You don't delay your release very long, but you prevent that guy from getting through the shield. And those guys just weren't there.
It seemed like Colorado was getting a little confused, too, by Michigan's. They were moving guys around a little bit pre-snap on punts. And Colorado actually took two delay of game penalties before punts. And one of them, it was a very obvious, like, they were trying to figure out what their blocking assignments were and just ran out of time.
Devin Bush was kind of moving around and they were pointing at stuff. And they looked to the sideline and then they just kind of relaxed. They're like, all right, we're going to take a 5-yard penalty. Which was interesting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they had the timeouts, but like if you're punting anyway, is the timeout worth the 5 yards?
It's an interesting little game theory thing there.
Yeah, it is.
Because I don't really know what the right answer is.
So, and then they started doing these rollout kind of rugby punts.
One went poorly. Very poorly. He hit that dude in the ribs.
He did. He hit one of his own personal protectors in the ribs, which is not the way to treat your own personal Secret Service.
No.
So my prediction from the game that special teams would be a huge advantage did come true.
It did.
Other things didn't.
And that Peppers would score also came true.
And the thing about Peppers on a punt return is that he has this thing where he just decides he's going to like glide to one side of the field, and then he detects the point at which he can change direction faster than humans.
And then hit it hard upfield.
Yeah. And then
insanely fast.
And then he's through the first wave and it's like, all right, well, what's going to happen now?
Yeah.
And the sheer consistency with which he's able to get through like the first 3 to 4 guys with that cut is, it's enticing.
It certainly is. I mean, his first 3 returns were 19, 13, and 13 yards. And they were all those kind of returns where he breaks through one ankle tackle or gets one more block and he is gone. It was, I think everybody in the press box called that he was going to bring one back by the end of the game because of the way it was looking early on.
Yeah, so obviously just a huge field position advantage for Michigan in addition to 2 freaking touchdowns. However,
there were some other things.
There were some downsides here.
The kicking of the football.
So Allen just looked wrong. Like he couldn't get the ball to the end zone. He missed both his field goal attempts. His punting was
his kickoffs were going about 10 yards shorter than they normally do.
Yeah.
There was an illuminating post on Scouts Master Board. Alan True mentioned that Quinn Nordeen is injured and might not be available for a couple more weeks, which might explain why Allen continued to handle all 3 phases through the entirety of that game, because it certainly seemed like something was off there.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a concern going forward because you know, one of those field goals was, I think, 47 or something where you don't necessarily expect that he's going to knock it
through. Missed a 44-yarder.
Okay, so, like, that's outside of his proven range, but then, you know.
But the first one was 37.
Mm-hmm. So
and it wasn't a pretty kick either.
No. So that's, like, that's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
And then that frickin' punt formation.
Yeah, if you're going to line up at a pro-style punt formation, at least do it in a legal fashion where you're not going to get flagged for it.
Well, and they've got both gunners to one side, and
then they kick it again, and it's acres of space.
Well, they have both gunners to one side, and like they did this 3 times, and at no point did the punt go to the side of the field where the gunners were. And I'm just like,
that's probably not the design.
I don't know if Michigan thinks that they can block a ton of punts this year because they've gotten their hands on 3, and if they think that they can just get one per game because of something that they found in like the spread punting business. Maybe that's why they've gone with this because it was a clear downgrade in terms of coverage, right?
Yes. Like, it was back to the Hoke days of is anybody in the same area code here?
Yeah. And then, you know, Allen also had a difficulty trying to pin the opposition deep. It wasn't
the one time he did it successfully. Michigan called a timeout right before he got it off, which was aggravating.
So, while special teams were a completely huge win overall, there were some
still a mixed bag. Somehow.
Yeah, still some concerns. And of course, Colorado also missed a field goal from within 40, but that was kind of their kicker's established performance level.
Yeah, that was not a surprise coming from them.
He's not that great.
No,
not that great. This is usually where we talk about game theory, and I didn't have anything from this game, but I did have something from the Michigan State Notre Dame game.
Oh, I know what this is.
Oh, you know what it is because I went off on Twitter about it because there are some people out there I would like to play again in poker. So it's 36-7, and obviously your biggest problem is that you let it get to 36
to 7.
Yeah,
that is the biggest issue.
But you know at some point you need a two-point conversion. You also know that if Michigan State scores, you're completely 100% done. So in that situation, you go as quickly as possible.
Because you then establish how many possessions you need to catch up.
Not only that, this is a weird corner case, but let's say you score a touchdown and you miss the first two-point conversion. So now you actually have a chance to get it back. So you need to score three more touchdowns, and you can go for it, go for two again.
Yes.
And then if you get both of those, you're back to a one-score game. So you give yourself multiple ways to make it a one-score game.
This was not Brian Kelly's thinking.
No, really. Brian Kelly just scored kick, scored kick, scored kick, and then he took a timeout and frickin' punted down eight. And like this,
not ideal.
This game was actually a perfect example of why you go early, because Notre Dame has the ball with 4 minutes left. They're down eight. They don't actually know if they're down seven or they're down nine.
Yeah.
And if they are, if they know they're down seven, then maybe you can punt it and get it back. If you're down nine, you're going for it on fourth and seven. And you're probably still boned, but at least you're making the right decision instead of a decision you hope will be made right by a thing that you do in the future.
And of course, State is able to grind out the clock
on
a coverage bust and the end around.
Yes.
Which was
God, the coverage bust. We'll talk about that with Jamie, I think.
Some yeah.
More. But this was just something that you know I got into on Twitter with some people, and it's just like, you know, the people who are like, no, now you got to keep it a one-score game. I'm like, no, that's not a one-score game.
No, it's not. It really is not.
I just headbutted the mic. We strive to make this the most visual of all podcasts.
This is a professional podcast,
and it was a stop saying it like that. And this was a really dramatic headbutting of the mic to express my discontent at a minor game theory point in a game that Michigan didn't even play in. This is our podcast.
Very professional.
Ace.
All right, in the middle of this very professional podcast, we would like to thank our sponsors, who are Underground Printing and Mo's, the Alumni Association of the University of Michigan, Homeshore Lending, the Residence Inn Ann Arbor Downtown, Ann Arbor Elder Law, Michigan Law Grad, and Liz Crow.
All right, and with that, we're going to take a break, come back, and talk about the offense. In 1934, a salesman from Champion Sportswear walked into Mo's Sports Shop. There, he teamed up with George J. Mo to create the very first University of Michigan branded shirt. After seeing the high demand for this product, Champion went to the other Big Ten schools with the same proposal, and the collegiate apparel industry was born. Mo Sports Shops is celebrating 100 years of outfitting the Michigan faithful. Visit us at our original 1915 location at 711 North University or online at 100years.mo. That's 100years.moe.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom-printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor. From San Francisco to St. Louis to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
When I look outside my window, I see troubles in my past. And I've got this strange feeling inside. Better get up, cause this could be my last. The pain doesn't come from leaving this life I've known behind. But I'm looking ahead. Cause I've been seeing through eyes that were blind.
So Michigan's offense was
started out a little rough.
Yes. So the Wilton Spate starts out bad meme. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was really rough for the better part of two quarters where he's thrown into coverage. He's throwing it where there's nobody else. He's
it looks like something's wrong with him after he takes the hit from Awuzie.
He takes some sacks. And, you know, the blindside hit on him was not at all his fault. That's something where you expect,
Blitz pickup, maybe?
Yeah, a blitz pickup. And I've looked at it. They slid the line to the left. So whenever you slide the line to the left, you're expecting the backs to pick up the slack on the backside if there's a blitz. And I'm like 99% sure that was Hill, who did not see the corner blitz and went into a pattern.
Mm.
So especially because that's like the area that he would be running his pattern into. That's something that he's really got to see.
Yeah. And that's also their most dangerous defensive player where that, you know, that's like, their Peppers. You need to be very aware of that guy.
Like, yeah, that's the guy who you are checking first and foremost to see if he's coming in on blitz. And he just blew it. He blew it big time. But on the other hand, he did have a day as a lead blocker. So the Smith touchdown down the sideline,
He took out basically two guys on that one.
He ran through impressive. A linebacker without losing any speed whatsoever. Yes. And then, I mean, he didn't really block the safety. The safety decided to cut him for some reason.
Yeah. Just kind of a dick move by that guy. Like, well, I'm not going to get anything, so I might as well, like, borderline hurt you.
But the fact that he was there erased that guy to get a 2-for-1 block on the edge, like a pure 2-for-1 block where you single-handedly take out two guys.
Don't see that often.
Separated by like 10 yards on the field. I don't know if I've ever seen that.
It was pretty cool. Davion Smith barely had to do anything on that run. He cut inside a block by Jake Butt at the goal line, and that was the first time he'd had to change direction.
And honestly, the thing that really surprised me is that Hill had the wherewithal to do that. Like,
yeah, his awareness in the open field was impressive.
Because
he could identify another guy right away.
You know, if he had stopped and been like, you know what, I'm going to erase this guy, then I'm happy with that block.
Yeah,
I'm like,
fine.
Great
Good
block,
job.
Plus one. But to just blow through that dude and then kind of know that he doesn't have to stay there,
he can just
keep going. I mean, that was more impressive than anything else.
Yes.
And then a lot of people are giving him a bunch of credit for the jet sweep, which I think is dubious.
I give him credit for getting out as quickly as he did on that one, because I think the corner definitely just sort of flailed. I mean, there's no quid. This was not Khalid Hill pancaking a guy. This was a guy mostly pancaking himself.
Yes.
But he was so far downfield so quickly that the two guys in pursuit kind of had to either alter their routes or were held up by the fact that he was out there. And that, I think, gave Chesson enough room to fully have the edge in the sideline without really any reason.
Well, so
you're not as impressed with his athletic ability as I am.
He's out there. I'm glad that he's out there.
I would say that most fullbacks are not in that position. And I think Khalid Hill should get credit for that.
Maybe. I just, you know, I saw that on replay and I was just like, what does that quarterback think he's doing?
I mean,
like, not only.
I think that guy knew he was dead.
Not only does he, like, run away, like Khalid Hill is the rabbit in Monty Python, but as he runs away, he falls over and then he trips one of his teammates.
Yeah, that was poorly done on his
part.
Like,
if he had just done what the safety did on the Devion Smith touchdown and just been like, oh, well, I'm going to cut you, then I think that
pursuit might get there.
Yeah,
might get
there.
Which is why I'm giving Hill credit for staying out in front. Thank you very much.
I chalk that up to the opponent. But in any case, one of Michigan's biggest plays of this game, the Smith touchdown, was largely Khalid Hill.
Yeah. Newsom also got out pretty quickly on a corner and affected him. He had a lot of chances to show that he gets out in space really nicely in this game.
Yeah, and the super deep pulls that I kind of noted in the last game do seem to be intentional. And
yes.
I think what the problem was there was not actually Newsom's problem.
It was the other guys inside of him not picking up their assignments.
Right. So, well, you know, Newsom pulls really deep and then someone else takes the force guy.
Yeah.
And that's Newsom's job. Like on that play, he got out and he kicked out the cornerback who was the force guy.
Yeah.
So in the last game, by the time the force guy got to him, he had already been picked up. So that's more like a Chesson issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't actually retroactively go back and deneg people.
Yeah.
In UFR, because I've got another UFR to do this week. But I think that, you know, some of the mental issues that I thought I spotted with Newsom last week. Were actually him doing his job.
Yeah, and he's just freaky mobile for a guy who's that big. On the Darbo touchdown right before the half, the guy who's trailing him and is the first one to congratulate him in the end zone is Grant Newsom.
I did not notice that.
He was downfield far. he's moving.
Yeah, and I haven't obviously offensive line play is difficult to assess. There was one incident where Newsom did get Spate blown up where he lost a guy inside, got off balance. But I think that's probably the only incident where his pass blocking failed him. So that would be two bad events in three games now, which is...
For a first-year starting left tackle, mm-hmm. we're good with
especially that. Especially given all the chatter from the offseason when he did in spring. I'm pleased with how the Newsom experiment is going.
Same here. I was very concerned when it seemed like a true freshman might start at left tackle.
Yeah. And they did alternate Braden and Bredesen some in this game. I'm pretty sure Braden got the large bulk of the snaps, so Bredesen did get in some.
Yeah, that was my impression as well, but it was tough to track mm-hmm. on the box.
So we'll have more on that later in the week, but it seems like maybe Braden's getting healthier and reasserting his...
I mean, they were running between the tackles pretty well when they decided to do so. They didn't do it that often, but... They averaged 5 yards a carry in this game. I know that includes a bunch of jet sweeps and the long carry by Smith, but they were getting movement up front when they needed to.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty clear in the second half especially.
Yeah.
And then Devion Smith had a good day. I thought he missed one cut early, but again, that's hard to tell without the tape.
Yeah.
And then there was definitely a certain stomping the villagers flat kind of vibe to the rest of his day.
Yeah. He also had a couple, I mean, even though they didn't actually go anywhere, he had two tough catches out of the backfield, I think on the same drive where he had like a little flat route that was thrown low that he managed to snag.
Mm-hmm.
And then a tough swing route that he caught that ended up getting tackled in the backfield, but the play was just dead to
that
right.
That was actually deflected and he still managed to bring it in.
And so...
He really should have dropped it. But
I mean, but ideally...
Can't coach that into anybody without... Bad things happen.
Yeah, you don't want to make a player think actively too much on the field.
And Jake Butt, I thought I caught him making a couple of important blocks. Like on the Isaac touchdown, I think he had a key block. And I just, it's, again, hard to tell because blocking is very difficult. But he really picked up his blocking last week, and I think that continued this week. So
yeah, I didn't notice any busts from him. And the ones that he had against Hawaii were pretty obvious.
Yeah.
So it at least was an improvement from there. Also, on that Isaac touchdown run, I actually really liked. I mean, it's a one-yard touchdown run, so there's only so much you can impress on that. But Isaac really held up and waited to set up his blocks on that, and he absolutely needed to do that because I think I had a chance to look at the replay, and I think Khalid Hill and Grant Newsom initially were targeting the same guy, and Hill realized this and altered his path and picked off another guy, but it required a bit of a delay from Isaac to set that up, and he waited and timed it perfectly and then just exploded into the end zone. I thought that was, as 1 yard touchdowns go, a nice one.
And then we have to talk some more probably about the really bad thing, which is the passing game overall. So we mentioned that Spate had a pass to Smith about 2 yards downfield that he had to pull off his shoe tops.
Yes.
Which is not something we saw from him in the first two games where he's just scattering the ball anywhere. I don't know if pressure got to him because I
think the hit that Awuzie laid on him dinged up his elbow, and he was sporting a pitcher after a 140 pitch outing type of ice pack on his on his elbow after the game in the post game presser. I think and it certainly seemed like after that he was kind of guiding the ball a little bit and that he wasn't fully comfortable with some of his throws because a lot of those were off in a way that made him look like a completely different quarterback from what we've seen the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I think that hit affected him, and I'm not sure it was mental as much as it was physical.
Well, there were some mental issues. He was thrown into coverage a lot.
He did make some bad reads, absolutely.
And Colorado has a much better secondary than they've seen before, but it's still just like, dude, you cannot make that throw. Like, he threw a near pick six to Butt, went to just kind of
late to
out
the flat
to the sideline.
And fluttering. That was a bad throw.
Like, as soon as it's out of his hand, the entire stadium's like, no, no. And the guy is just one step away from it. So, tough outing for him. And, young quarterbacks are going to have this happen from time to time. But that whole, best case scenario thing I said after the UCF game. Not so much.
We'll see. I did
a UCF team that took Maryland to overtime,
double overtime,
which we'll talk more about with Jamie.
And
then someone on Twitter said, "Nice win for DJ Durkin."
Beautiful. I will say with Spate that I was impressed with his ability, mostly in the second half. I thought he was doing a great job of stepping up in the pocket, avoiding the rush, and then finding guys downfield. He did it on the big play to Grant Perry.
Mm-hmm.
He did that with Jake Butt a couple times. He had a couple scrambles where, you know, they didn't gain many yards, but he
best scrambles.
He at least turned what could have been a sack into a slightly positive yardage. I would prefer that he not get hit, and the naked bootleg that they ran in the second half, I was really confused
by. It was terrible.
I don't know why that's even in the playbook with him as the quarterback, and especially in a game where he got nailed and seemed to be affected by it.
Well, so the thing about that bootleg is he gains like 2 yards on it.
Yep.
And any other guy gets a first down.
Yes. That was watching John DeVar run a naked bootleg.
Yes. And the thing about it is he took this hit before he gets out of bounds, and he takes it like he's a tackling dummy. Like, he's not trying to get down. He's not trying to get forward.
Yeah, no, he's fully upright and not really leaning into it and just gets thwapped.
It's like, here are my ribs. Please bruise them, sir. So
maybe don't.
All assertions about how he's not John DeVar are over. He's John DeVar.
He's John DeVar.
I mean, he can move around in the pocket, and maybe John couldn't do that very early in his career. But, like, once he crosses the line of scrimmage, 100% DeVar.
Yep.
Which means he's going to run 50 yards against Iowa. So,
hey, if they run a transcontinental, I will be totally okay with that.
And then they had weird cameos from the other quarterbacks.
That they did. They brought on the Kaiju Package Peppers and Shane Morris for the same play.
Yeah, and they had a pitch sweep to Peppers where Morris was the lead blocker, which went about as well as you might expect. He kind of flailed at someone's legs, but the effort was there.
He's going for it.
And I just, it was interesting because that's like, all right, well, now we're 11 on 11 again. That's like a spread run principle because you have a blocking quarterback.
Yeah.
Which is a concept.
And then they brought on like every tight end on the roster.
Right. So it's 2nd and 10. And Khalid Hill's on the field, and 4 other tight ends are on the field, so it's a 5 tight end package. And
John O'Korn is in the game because they apparently could switch quarterbacks when they bring on these weird packages.
And they just kind of run straight ahead for 2 yards, and I'm like,
I assume this is them putting something on tape that they're setting up for later, but man, I'm not sure what they're doing from that.
Like that's a play where you run it on 2nd and 4 or something, you know? Yeah. Don't
leave yourself in like, this is probably going to be a 3rd and long.
Right, yeah.
Like, in a game that's still quite competitive at the time.
Yeah. And then they actually ran, I think it was like just a quarterback sweep, like some zone read principles with O'Korn late, which gained a few yards. So they're putting him in the game.
That one was after the game was in hand.
Yeah, they were just trying to run out the clock. So it was like third.
Yeah, that was a run, punt sequence.
Yep. And then Butt had 7 catches, 8 catches for 87 yards.
7 for 87.
And he was like the one consistent target that was open and catching the ball.
Those drag routes really working. Colorado, for whatever reason, seemed completely incapable of guarding those.
No, they were just completely lost in space on those. And then they tried a bunch of bombs deep to like Darbo, and
none of which were anywhere
near working.
It was mostly early on, and I think they really wanted, because you know, Jay Uchesson didn't have a catch in this game. And I think Awuzie was on him for most of the game, and Awuzie did a pretty darn good job of taking him out. And so I think they were trying to pick on Akella Witherspoon, the other corner, because he's not quite as talented as Awuzie. But he's big and he's pretty fast, and he was good on deep stuff against Colorado State, and he was good on deep stuff in this one. I've kind of dialed back the Amaro Darbo is maybe much faster than he was last year, because all of a sudden that didn't quite look like the case. Because there were some questionable throws by Spade on those, but Darbo also had 0 separation downfield.
Yeah. Well, and some of that is on Spate, because there was one incident where, okay, the cornerback's over the top and you want to throw a back shoulder and you threw it to the inside, especially because they're running down the numbers, which is actually a route win for Darbo, because now he has 5 yards to the sideline where the cornerback can't get to it.
Yes.
There's a huge back shoulder window there that Spate just flat out missed. So even if the cornerback's on top of you, if you are at the numbers, if you're not on the sideline, you have a lot of room with which to make a catch if the quarterback puts it in the right spot, and he did not. So I think some of the Darbo problems are Darbo problems because he's just not JHS and fast.
Yeah.
And then some of them were Spate's sudden inaccuracy in the play. I mean, the thing that you said earlier about how he looked like a different quarterback does, I mean, he did, because in the first couple games he was accurate almost beyond expectations.
Yes.
And in this one he was very much not that.
And there were throws that, I mean, he was really sailing them. Wasn't throwing tight spirals. I really think his elbow was dinged up there, and might actually speak to how far ahead he is of John O'Korn at this point. That it doesn't even really seem like it was under consideration to put O'Korn in the game.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because, you know, if you were ever going to pull a guy in a close quarterback competition, it would have been after that first quarter plus.
Yes.
Because, man.
Where some of the less polite Michigan Stadium denizens were booing, which, come
jerks.
On, man.
Come on.
Oh, my God. I didn't get this fan review out because I had basically no reception the entire game.
Yeah, you were quiet.
Had no reception.
Not my choice. like you said, it might have been a blessing.
Yeah. But there's this guy who's like, down in front, down in front, down in front. And I turn around, and he's 25 or something.
No.
He's like, he's 10 years younger than me. He's like a bro. And I'm like, what? What is going on?
Is it like a disease or something?
I have no idea. So I should also amend my my review of the guy who looks like one of the dudes from Flight of the Conchords who was clapping arrhythmically. They left with 5 minutes left in the second quarter.
What?
So I'm upgrading him from 2 of 10 to 3 of 10.
Added elbow room.
Well, he's just and like he's just not there. He's not as annoying for as long. So, yeah,
that's good.
I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast. We sit directly behind all the seats that IMG get.
Yeah.
So everybody in that section
crowd
has no idea how to act. They're all taking selfies of them next to the field.
They don't know what to do with pom-poms when those are handed out.
Yes. It's just they stand on the benches during big games. It's a nightmare. I hate all those tickets so badly. And there's always like pockets of people like standing up and you never know like where those people are going to be. There's no consistency. Like if you're in a season ticket area, you kind of know who's around you and you know like this is the guy who pops up all the time. This is the guy who stands up too much. This is the guy who yells. They're just always different. So it's navigating the changing seat dynamics directly behind the IMG yobs is just it's a constant trial.
But we do get these wonderful fan reviews on Twitter now, so there is an upside.
The Heath Slater guy was actually in a regular season ticket seat, so he sometimes
that's good. He's sticking around. That's nice.
They don't for some reason. Also, the people behind me never show up except to like one game a year. Anyway, this has been me complaining about the people around me in Michigan Stadium. Hopefully, you are not some of those people. Let's take a break. Come back. Talk about the D.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages $90,000. It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest from Homeshare Lending. By now, you've probably read about my company on MGO blog, and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the most important people in my life, my sons Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
I'm 7 and a half.
Colby, how old are you?
I'm 5.
Okay, boys, I have 3 really important questions to ask you. Who's your favorite team?
Michigan.
Who's going to win the big game?
The Wolverines.
And if you could buy or refinance a house with any company, who would you use?
Homeshare Lending.
Good boys. Homeshare Lending, 855-6-BE-SURE. Visit us online if that works better for you, homeshurelending.com, H-O-M-E-S-U-R-E, lending.com. We've helped Brian, Seth, and a bunch of readers buy or refinance their homes, and we'd love to help you too. All right, only thing left to do. Boys, can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue.
Homeshare Lending, NMLS number 1161358. Again, give us a call, 855-6-BE-SURE.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, fully equipped kitchen and every suite and an indoor pool. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
As Jim Harbaugh and the 2016 Michigan Wolverines begin their journey towards a 43rd Big Ten championship and 12th national title, it's important that you're also preparing for this historic season. If you find yourself on the wrong side of the law, in Ann Arbor or around Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man in the huddle. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, MichiganLawGrad.com.
So the defense was horrendous up until
the second quarter,
the very end of the first quarter. They're still on this drive, right? They're threatening to go up 28-7. I'm setting all things on fire in my mind. I'm coming home. I'm setting my home on fire. I'm calling up the server company to set our server on fire. We're just setting everything on fire. Michigan stiffens, gets a field goal attempt that is missed. And from then on, with one very bad but very limited exception, they're dialed in, and it's punt, 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 punt.
Yep. Other than there was the 70-yard touchdown, and there were 9 punts and a turnover on downs.
Yep. So how do we feel about that? I feel
That is also how I feel. I mean, the run-pass options with the slant, that was just absolutely killing them.
Screaming
over and over and over,
and
I mean, this was the game where Jordan Lewis's absence showed itself the most, because ideally you have him in the slot and he's all over those routes. He's the one guy who can reliably stick on that.
I mean, if you do, you have that option. To me, the thing is remember when Rich Rodriguez started running all those pop passes? He kind of invented the pop pass.
Yeah.
And they were awesome for about half a season. And then they were a recipe for getting your guy just absolutely hammered by
yes.
a safety. Michigan safeties are not hammering these routes.
No.
And I talked about this last week in the UFR, where they had one of those pop slants that was wide open, but McCray deflected it. And I pointed out that on the backside of that play, you have Demonte Thomas and you have Clark, and there's literally nobody out there who's an eligible receiver because they lined up unbalanced.
Yes.
So their tight end is covered up on the other side of the line. So what is Demonte Thomas guarding? Air.
Yep.
And that's fine, but as soon as you see the direction of that play, where it's going,
you need to bug out for that.
Yeah, you need to look for that pop slant and put your shoulder into the midsection of the person as he's trying to catch the ball.
It was funny, kind of the one time where it seemed like they managed to do that was the play after Delano Hill exited because he was dinged up for a play and Tyreek Kinnell came on. They tried to target Kinnell on that, and then he guarded it well that they ended up. I think they might have even had to come off of that and throw it another slant coming in, and it actually got broken up, and with the safety flying down to threaten the hit was a part of it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a where was this all day moment.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm sure that Don Brown knows about pop passes.
Yes.
And I'm sure that he's got the ability to defend them. I just question how prepared these guys are in this defense right now. The safeties looked tentative the whole day.
They did, and I mean, Peppers busted an assignment on the first touchdown.
Which everybody is putting on Demonte Thomas
because he was the person in the area when
yes.
the pass landed. But they were doing the thing with Peppers where they have him play 8 yards deep and check run and still defend a deep third, because he can do that athletically. And he could have made this play if he didn't bite on the run, but he bit. And he left the middle of the field wide open, which is why Thomas was very far outside of the post.
Right.
That was a bust that Peppers took ownership of immediately in the post game.
Which is good, because I didn't like thinking that Demonte Thomas had just
had an awful game as yeah. opposed to a bad game.
A bad game. So he gets beat on that corner touchdown, which is like, that'll happen sometimes.
Yeah, there's safety playing man coverage.
He missed a couple of tackles, one of which was kind of an ankle broken situation that was ugly.
He really, really misplayed the ball on the flea flicker that probably should have been a touchdown, but their tight end dropped it because he was in position. He was in perfect position in coverage to make that play. And then when he turned to look for the ball, he just lost all contact.
Mm.
and that was not good.
Yeah, which is like don't turn to look for the ball in that situation.
Yeah, to stay connected with the receiver because mm-hmm. he had help over the top too.
Yeah, actually, I had assumed on my first viewing of that was a PBU, and then I saw the replay and I was like,
yep, that was just a drop.
So
that was a drop.
Just new defense concerns and costs, and I think we saw them on all three safeties.
Yeah, because Hill let the 70-yard post get over the top of him.
Yeah, which we should give credit to, I'm going to let you pronounce
it. Safo Leofau.
There you go.
yeah, throwing that on one leg.
Yes.
My God.
And he's getting blown up. Like, he got nailed on that throw.
Yes.
He's not even stepping into it. You know, as that ball leaves his hand, I'm like, well, that's going anywhere. And anywhere happened to be directly into the stride of his wide receiver.
Perfect spot. And this is not his game either. So,
no. I felt pretty bad about his performance in the first quarter because I'm just like, dude, I told everybody that this guy is a scattershot dude. He's just yep. Tom Brady out there. And then in the second quarter, we saw a lot of what we had discussed.
Yeah, there were some inaccurate throws.
There were some turfed balls.
The people who are saying that this is a completely different game if Leofau stays healthy through all of it, first of all, you have to account for the fact that the reason he's not healthy through all of it is the defensive line was murdering him on a very regular basis and the linebackers. And also, he played that whole second quarter, and Michigan completely shut Colorado down in the second quarter. They'd seem to have figured out what they needed to figure out by that point. So I'm not on the if Leofau stays upright through that game, Colorado stays close.
No, and then it was just totally over as soon as he went, where it's just like,
oh yeah, I mean, his backup was 0-for-7. That was wow. That was a drop off.
Wow. And then I think the thing that they did figure out is that they should stop blitzing all the time because it was leaving big pockets open.
Yeah. And the defensive line was doing a pretty good job of generating a rush on their own.
Yeah, especially
Rashawn Gary, man.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Man, you're just stealing my thunder.
Sorry.
Rashawn Gary, I wanted to say it. You're like, Rashawn Gary, I'm going to say it. Well, screw you, buddy. I said it too.
You left that little bit of dead air there, and I decided to fill it.
I'll leave your dead air. That doesn't...
Now, he had his first pressure, he went on a straight corner rush, and he bent the corner in a way that a 295-pound human being should not be able to do physically.
I thought it was 287 weight.
Whatever it is.
It's pounds less impressive, Ace.
It was, okay, fair enough. You know, might be getting a little hyperbolic. I will be prone to doing that with Rashawn Gary, I assume, for the next 3 years.
And that
it will be difficult to do because the things he's doing out there. I keep confusing him for Mike McCray on plays that he's pursuing because 3 and 9 kind of look the same from the press box. They kind of have a strangely similar build. And they're both pursuing plays sideline to sideline. So there are plays where I think that McCray is pursued and it turns out to be Gary. And then I pick up my jaw. He's an athlete.
Yeah. And that pressure that he got around the corner was at a critical point in the game. It's like 3rd and 10. Michigan's defense hasn't really stepped up. Like, this is still second quarter where you're kind of expecting Colorado to just go right down the field. He gets around the corner. He nails his name?
Safe to leave a foul.
There we go. And it's a totally different defense from that point because, you know, he's jittery, he's not as accurate, and he turns that game around.
And early on, Gary did not play much, I think, in the first
three series.
And that was a huge turning point in that game was when they took Winovich off and had Gary as the weak side end and Wormley as the strong side end and just went for full beef mode there. That worked because they were getting more pass rush.
They did definitely have a we're not screwing around line anymore.
Yeah, that was it.
Where they had both those guys on the ends and then Glasgow and Hurst in the middle. And I was like, this is what I was talking about. Yes.
Yeah. No, that was the full blown murder front right there. And mm-hmm. it worked.
And in regards to Rashawn Gary's athleticism, they had a run that went way outside to the field, just kind of an edge run. And I'm like, well, that's going to get 10 yards.
And he strings it out.
Gary strung it out. Like, I was like, wow.
Because the guy turned the corner and Hill had to push him out, but he turned the corner and got 2 yards.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
I was like, that is slightly impressive, Mr. Gary. I hope you continue improving. And of course, we haven't talked about Jabril Peppers yet. We talked about him blowing something, but he also did some things that were less
He also
bad.
Blew some people up.
Yes, 3.5 tackles for loss. He has 9.5 on the season, projected out over the course of an entire season. That is a lot.
Yeah, lots. We're like, going with lots.
It's like 40, which is
a reasonably decent number.
Which could get him to New York.
Especially if he continues to score touchdowns in other ways as well.
And then his sack, it was just amazing to watch, and you could see the quarterback fail to compute what was happening, where he's just like, this is not what a blitz is. This is some sort of rabid gopher shot out of a cannon.
And he timed that blitz beautifully. He went from not really threatening to all of a sudden just blowing by the left guard.
Yeah, and when he has kind of that run-up, he has time to watch the offensive line set up, and then the edge rusher takes away the tackle, and then he can just pick the spot where the guard isn't and go by him.
Yeah, and it was going to be really difficult for, even if Colorado had recognized that he was coming, with him blitzing in between the end and the tackle was lined up right over the left guard. So for the left guard to try to slide over and then have, I think it was Hurst, you'd have to turn him free and have the center try to slide over and pick him up. That was going to be tough on the quarterback, kind of no matter what happened there.
Yeah, and then we saw him in more of an edge role than we did against Central Florida.
Yeah, so they hung him. He blew up a couple screens.
There was one of those things where they're not even blocking him. And
bad idea. Just, really bad idea.
It's just like, what? I mean, I'm sure this wasn't your plan. Like, I'm sure that your plan involves, like, have someone try to block Peppers. But even so, what is your deal there?
Did you expect that to work?
Yeah.
it was nice to see screen killing Jabril Peppers back out there being in a position to make those plays.
It's still puzzling to me that wasn't constant. Like, they lined him up to the short side of the field with some frequency.
Yep.
And I'm just like, he should always be in that gray area. And if he wants to come down and blitz, that's fine. But it just seems like he should always be to the field.
Yeah, and in space.
In space and just shutting that off.
Yeah.
Because you don't really see many wide receiver screens to the boundary. It just doesn't happen.
No, it's really not a good idea.
So
unless you want your wide receiver to get hit by a defensive end.
No, but progress in that department, I think you see.
Yeah, because Colorado had a great screen game going in the first couple games this year, and that was not the case.
Yeah, they didn't really have anything. And Michigan was actually aligning kind of similarly to the way they did against UCF, where they're minus
kind
one.
Of daring you to throw it a little bit.
And they just didn't really do it.
Yeah.
And, I don't know.
Hill had a nice close and tackle for loss on a screen. They were good about shutting them down when they were faced with them.
And then Colorado's interior run game was close to nil.
Almost non-existent.
Like they might have popped off a 5 or 6 yard run maybe once, but there was nothing big, and there were a lot of 1 or 2 or 3 yard gains. And it's kind of difficult to tell who's going to get the most credit for that after I go over it in detail, but it's definitely going to be Glasgow.
Yeah. No. it's a reasonable guess at this point.
And of course, Wormley is also up there.
Gary also had a nice crash and tackle on an interior run where he made a play that most people don't make, I think it would be safe to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you definitely want to see Monet back. You definitely want to see Taco Charlton back.
Yes.
But the four guys that they put out there in their no-screwing-around package
are pretty
good players. It's just that the depth and the ability to get tempoed. And I think that was part of it early as well, is that Michigan had a couple of three-and-outs, and then Colorado's out there for a long time. And you don't really have the depth right now to rotate some guys out and have confidence that's going to go well.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that kind of steamroller effect kind of hit Michigan. And that's why the Gary PBU was so critical. It kind of gave them an opportunity to start with their own set of very short drives and get the rest they needed.
Yeah, there was a very clear turning point in that game,
yeah.
And it was right around there.
Most definitely. Anything else? Should I talk about the fans around me some more?
I did notice Jeremy Clark had one really nice pass breakup and then was not really targeted again. And in a game where a lot of guys were picked on, Stripling and Clark weren't really at all.
No, I mean, Stripling had a nice pass breakup as well. He gave up a couple of slants that were a little frustrating.
Although he was also the only one to really successfully break up a slant, too.
Yeah. But like those slants were at least kind of contested, and when they were completed, it was like 6, 7, 8 yards.
Yeah, which was much better than the ones that were
the pop slants
out
over the court.
The safeties. Yeah.
So gonna have to work on the safeties. I don't really know what you do. The seniors are just getting more comfortable in the defense, I guess. Maybe cut back on the blitzing because you don't really need to do it.
Yeah, and you know they are missing an All-American cornerback right now.
Yeah.
I assume that changes up how they even approach defending a lot of these types of plays when you have that guy available, because they had Brandon Watson out there for I think one snap and he got burned.
No, he actually got a fair number of snaps.
Okay. There was the one that I noticed where he got burned and then also overran the tackle attempt after he'd given up a catch over the middle that was not ideal.
Yeah, so they're using Watson as a nickel corner sometimes. I assume that when Lewis is back, that'll be him.
Yeah.
And then they have a different kind of dime package where they'll bring in Cannell. So I would assume that he would also get all of those snaps. And then he's sending Clark and Stribling to the bench for periods of time.
Yeah.
So they definitely need him back. Hopefully they'll get it by Wisconsin. Honestly, do they need him back for Wisconsin? Probably not.
We'll see.
I mean, we'll see. Penn State does. They don't really loom.
No.
I would say they're
there.
They're there. But with their offensive line, I'm not that concerned about what Penn State's going to do in the passing game. Because the things that they're going to try to do in the passing game are just bomb it deep to Godwin and those guys. And, you know, Stribling and Clark have proven that they're good in those situations.
Yeah, if that's what they're relying on to get their yardage other than trying to smash Barkley into that front.
Yeah. Where Michigan
pretty good about that.
Where Michigan really misses Lewis is on short routes.
Yes,
like he could cover those slants a lot better. He can definitely be a slot corner and be a superior slot corner. So
yes.
The upcoming matchups. I mean, I think we might get Lewis back and Taco back for Penn State, but even if we don't, I don't think that's going to be that material to the outcome.
Hopefully not. I think if they start the game with the defensive front that they eventually settled on in this one, the game probably goes a little differently.
Rashawn Gary against Penn State defensive line. Woo!
Yeah, I'm okay with that. And I mean, we really did see in this game how, I mean, even when there are some issues in the secondary, that defensive line and the linebackers blitzing can cover up for quite a bit.
Yep. All right, take a break. We'll come back. Talk to Jamie.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor, from San Francisco to St. Louis, to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest from Homeshare Lending. By now, you've probably read about my company on MGO blog, and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the most important people in my life, my sons Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
I'm 7.5.
Colby, how old are you?
I'm 5.
Okay, boys, I have 3 really important questions to ask you. Who's your favorite team?
Michigan.
Who's going to win the big game?
The Wolverines.
And if you could buy or refinance a house with any company, who would you use?
Homeshare Lending.
Good boys. Homeshare Lending, 855-6-BE-SURE. Visit us online if that works better for you. Homeshurelending.com, HOMESURE Lending.com. We've helped Brian, Seth, and a bunch of readers buy or refinance their homes, and we'd love to help you too. All right, only thing left to do. Boys, can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue.
Homeshare Lending, NMLS number 1161358. Again, give us a call, 855-6-BE-SURE.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom-printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our 3 convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com. If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, fully equipped kitchen and every suite and an indoor pool. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
Just a sight. Thought I had a dream once. Don't remember why. Your voice cut straight through me, right down to my bones, like a winter's wind. It knocked out my soul. Thought I some time here. Left my watch at home. Thought I had ideas once. They were all on loan. Thought I conquered something. And it took me down. What I thought I heard clearly. It wasn't sound.
We welcome in Jamie Mack of JustCoverBlog.com. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing great. I'm just trying to figure out how we could schedule a Western Michigan, North Dakota State game so we can settle the Big Ten West title once and for all.
Yes.
Oh. Zinger, let's start off with that. North Dakota State 23, Iowa 21.
Big winner here, Bill Connolly, I would say.
You guys don't follow Bill Connolly on Twitter. He posts previews of every team in the offseason.
He's the S&P Plus guy.
Yeah, and he uses his own numbers. And they weren't really high on Iowa. Because they shouldn't have been, and Iowa right. fans were
indignant.
They hated him, and they kept yelling at him. And now they don't. They're not yelling at Bill Connolly anymore.
They're yelling at Kirk.
Well, there's always been a level of schedule friendliness too to Iowa's success as far as last year and even at the start of this year. And you know, I don't know about how Conley's box score is gonna look. Cause I haven't looked at the advanced stats yet for this, but I know that 8 of 11 Iowa's drives only went for 16 yards or less yesterday, including 11 that went for 0 or negative yards, and 4 of their last 6 drives qualify there. So they had 0 offense. They only had 64 total yards in the second half. And they just couldn't get anything going at all.
Yeah, this isn't sacks removed, but when you're playing a 1AA team, even a national title contending 1AA team, you know,
not a 1AA team.
They really are. But 25 carries for 34 yards, I would say, is still a red flag.
Wow, that's their whole rushing output. Yeah,
that is their entire rushing
and
output.
And how much yardage did NDSU rush for?
239.
So this was in no way. Oh, any kind of fluke?
No, if anything, it was fluky that Iowa was winning until the final kick.
Well, at least they didn't extend Kirk Ferentz for another decade.
Yeah,
immediately prior to this game.
Thank goodness they didn't do anything like that, and then you know, guarantee his buyout if he wins 7 games a year.
at least they can now get rid of him in fairly short order.
Yep.
God, I mean, the one hand, this isn't really surprising because nobody should ever schedule North Dakota State.
No, this extended
they're up there with Air Force and like Georgia Tech and Georgia State, who we'll talk about.
Since 2010, future. They've won more games against FBS competition than Kansas. They've had far fewer opportunities to do so, and yet they've still done that.
Yeah, so just don't schedule these guys. No offense, Bison, but
yeah, and. Yards per play was 6.8 to 3.2 in favor of the Bison.
Wow.
While Iowa had no offense, North Dakota State spent the whole day in Iowa territory. 9 of their 11 drives went into Iowa territory. And, you know, Ace mentioned the rushing numbers, but they gashed them all day. They had like 5 plays, I think, that went over 20 yards in the rushing.
Yeah, they didn't have a 100. They had a guy rush for 99, but they didn't have a 100-yard rusher. They had a balanced rushing attack that still managed to absolutely carve up Iowa.
And so did they just kick all field goals? Well, how did this not end up just a blowout?
They missed one field goal. I'm not sure how they did not end up.
How does one get 23?
Their quarterback threw a pick.
That's like a score I would predict. 23 is not a score that comes up very much.
No, it is not.
They went for 2 after a fourth quarter touchdown.
I see.
With like 3 or 4 minutes to go and missed it. So it stayed 21-20. And then Iowa had a chance to run the clock out, but they went backwards on their drive, had to punt it away, and North Dakota State kicked the game with time.
Wow. Well,
that's how it landed on 23.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously this downgrades the intimidation factor of going to Iowa. I don't know how much, because, like, was this really that much of an upset?
I'll put it this way. I wasn't shocked.
Well, I mean, by Vegas, it was a big upset, right? Like, what was the line?
Yeah, I think Iowa was favored by 3
like
scores.
16 points. Yeah. That surprised me. And at the same time, I was not, for whatever reason, I was not in taking those points. I watched the Iowa-Illinois State game. You know, they had Trey Roberson. They were pretty good. And they sort of dominated them. So I kind of thought that maybe this was a step up for North Dakota State. Some of those teams they've beaten at this level haven't been very good. They've beaten Iowa State twice. They beat a totally rebuilding Kansas State team. That doesn't take anything away from them. They'd probably easily be in the top 50, maybe in FBS. But
what do you think the projected score of?
Yeah, the line was big. The line was big, and it grew. It grew all week. It opened up at less than two touchdowns. Everybody was betting Iowa for some reason.
What do you think the projected score of a North Dakota State versus Rutgers game would be? What's the line on that?
Home field doesn't even matter here.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, if North Dakota State got out to a 21-0 lead like New Mexico did, I know they wouldn't blow it.
Yeah, let's not talk about that just yet. Let's talk about
possibly ever.
A near upset, Wisconsin 23, Georgia State 17. As I just mentioned, Georgia State is definitely on the list of teams to never, ever play. Even though they lost to Ball State this year, they do run
it. They're 0-3, but...
But it's they put a scare into a couple teams last year. Didn't they beat Florida?
I think so.
Yeah, they beat Florida.
They almost did, yeah.
They have like that crazy Willie Fritz offense. Like, it's just not... Not good to go up against it. I mean, the concern for Wisconsin is not giving up 17, I think, to this offense, but only scoring 23 on a defense that gave up far more than that to a MAC team.
Yeah, Georgia State had played Boston along 5.8 yards per rush. Wisconsin had only had 3.8 yards on 49 attempts. They just kept pounding it and pounding it, but they couldn't really sustain any drives when it counted. 9 of their 11 drives went into Georgia State territory, including all 5 of their first half drives, and they only had 6 points at halftime. They had 23 points out of their 8 trips inside Georgia State's 40-yard line. That's less than 3 points per trip. That's one of Bill Conley's 5 factors of winning. They were one of the worst in the country at that last year, so that's still a problem. And in this game, they made a quarterback change. Bart Houston only had 91 yards on 18 attempts, and they made a switch midway in the third quarter, and that got their offense going a little bit. They went with the redshirt freshman, Alex Hornibrook. They just look really clunky. Corey Clement was out yesterday, and they just don't seem to have any playmakers without him. We thought one had developed in the opener with Troy Fumagalli, but he left in the first quarter and never came back, so his status is uncertain as Wisconsin really starts part of their schedule with at Michigan State and at Michigan.
Yeah, this would be a really bad time for them to be down Clement and Fumagalli.
And starting a redshirt freshman quarterback.
That too.
Yeah.
Who put up a good stat line, but also threw a pick in the...
Well, moving on, Nebraska 35, Oregon 32 in a game that redeems the Big Ten West in terms of schedule strength. This was a crazy game where Oregon goes for 2 on every touchdown, gets it once, and then loses by the field goal they left on the field with their 2-point conversions.
Whoops.
Which is, I mean, I know that it's served them well in previous games, but going for 2 is not always great, especially when your offense isn't like a vintage Oregon offense.
No.
Yeah. Well, I personally ended up hating the decisions because I had Oregon plus 3, so I ended up, well, I didn't lose, I didn't win. I could have used one extra point somewhere along the way, Coach Helfrich. But I think once you get that first one, which they did, that's your advantage right there. Why cough it up by continuing to risk them, you know, continuing to risk the extra point? And I think once you get that first one, that's a pretty strong edge, you know, especially like you said, you know, if they still had Marcus Mariota and company, yeah, well, fine, go keep going. But yeah, I think they had a very interesting edge early on, and they gave it up. Oregon still ended up winning the yards per play, 6.9 to 5.0.
Well, and I think that's somewhat expected because Nebraska is more of a grinded out offense than Oregon is Oregon.
Yeah, they made Divine Izbigbo their primary ball carrier coming out at halftime, and he really ran hard. And he and Tommy Armstrong, they combined for 190 rushing yards on 37 attempts, but 158 of those were in the second half.
And so they're running Tommy Armstrong now like they should have done all of last year. Is that how many rushes did he have in this game?
16.
Like they just figured it out. They're like, man, this guy can run a little bit, and he's a terrible passer.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they might have had some not so positive reinforcement on that because at least according to Twitter, he was looking pretty banged up by the end of this game.
Well, I mean, they did get a win over Oregon. I mean, that's a big thing for their program.
It is.
You know, back in the opener, just to give you some perspective on the usage of Armstrong, back in the opener against, not Wyoming, that was last week, against Fresno State, he had more rushing attempts than passing attempts. The first time that had happened since early in his sophomore.
Well, that's the way to use him. I'm also just deeply offended when Nebraska doesn't have some version of option in their offense.
Yeah, this was the team that had the crazy, like, we're not even mad, we're impressed double option play that they ran against Michigan.
Just their history and stuff. Like, if they do move on from this guy, they should hire,
I don't know, a triple option guy. That's what they should do. That's just what they should do.
Pulling guys out of the service academies.
Western Michigan 34, Illinois 10. I don't have anything else to say.
Everything went as expected.
Well,
the one thing I do have to say is that Illini, who is a very good Illinois fan, a very long-suffering Illinois fan, tweeted out, "The frustrating thing about this game to me is that Western Michigan is talking so much smack and we can't do anything about it," which is just Illinois football in a nutshell. And he's a great fan.
The stat of this game is the fact that Illinois had three total rushing yards.
My God. Mm-hmm. Throw the boat.
And I believe Western's running back was pretty dominant.
Yeah, 24 carries for 189 yards.
This is another, like which one is the Big Ten team?
Which is the Big Ten team again?
Yeah. Which is the Big Ten team? Western Michigan is the Big Ten team.
Are we allowed to trade? Can we do promotion relegation
right
now?
We should. We should totally do it.
We should.
You know, one thing I want to point out is that now that P.J. Fleck is at Western Michigan, the Western Central game is the best fire-up slogan matchup in the country. Row the boat versus fire-up chips.
Yeah.
No contest!
It's strong.
Totally. Absolutely.
Strong work there. Northwestern 24, Duke 13.
Abomination of
off
a game.
Off the Schneid.
Off the Schneid, and they were still calling for Mick McCall's head for most of the game.
Total yardage for the Northwestern offense?
Let me pull it up real quick.
He's pulling it up, everybody. Let's play some pulling it up music.
It's way more than I expected. It is 406 yards.
How's that an abomination? That's more than Michigan got. I mean, it did involve Jabril Peppers.
I was just seeing the Northwestern tweets where they were saying that the next time he calls for a speed option, he should be fired. And considering that Clayton Thorson's their quarterback, I'm inclined to believe those were some really ugly speed options. And Northwestern's been known to do those under Mick McCall.
Well, a week ago they threw Thorson for 41 times. They actually had 39 pass attempts last night. Frustration is the fact that they had 44 rushing attempts and only gained 86 yards. They could not rush the football.
Justin Jackson's
Thorson
good.
Still threw, I believe, three picks. So that's still, you know, even if he was more effective gaining yards to the ground, he was still making mistakes. And they just couldn't run the football, and they kept trying it.
Unstoppable throw guy Trevor Siemian isn't walking through that door.
No, he is not.
No, he is not.
He is a starting NFL quarterback.
Justin Jackson, though, did at least play. You know, I think when we were talking last week on the podcast, status was uncertain. But they gave him 28 carries, and he only averaged 3.4 yards per pop, rather. So that's
a Justin Jackson game.
Yeah, right, exactly. But it doesn't win you ball games when you don't have anything else.
No, except against Duke, apparently.
Yep.
Duke,
maybe not so good
at
football. David
Cutler should have taken the Michigan job. What can we say?
Right? let's move on to the other division. Maryland 30, UCF 24 in double overtime, which of course makes us feel better about getting out hit by UCF last week.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, the score makes it look like there was some action, but that was mostly done in overtime. It was 17 all at the end of regulation. There just wasn't a lot of offense. First nine drives of this game, only one went for more than 27 yards. The teams combined for 9 out of 32 on third down. And UCF tied it, I think, late in the third quarter, maybe really early in the fourth quarter, on a field goal to make it 17 all, and then there was only 65 total yards in offense game. So,
Maryland really lucky to win this game because UCF outgained them by 80 yards. It was 458 to 373. If UCF doesn't lose the turnover battle,
4-0.
They lost three fumbles.
They lost the turnover battle against Maryland.
Yeah.
4-0.
Yes.
Right.
This is both an accomplishment by UCF and a very good way to lose. UCF should have won that game.
Did they not throw the ball? Did Maryland just have like four passing attempts? Because that's the only way I can conceive of them getting through a game without turning the ball.
Perry Hills was 10 of 23.
They were 10. Perry Hill was 10 for 20 for like 127 yards. So
yep.
He was not very effective. But he didn't throw a pick. And they're three games into the season, and he has not thrown a pick.
Yeah, but what's his yards per attempt? He might just be throwing nothing but screens.
His yards per attempt on the season, actually a solid 7.7.
But yesterday was pretty shaky, 5 points.
All right, let's move on to
the headliner.
The headliner of the week. Rutgers 37, New Mexico 28. New Mexico was actually up 21-0 in this game and somehow blew it.
Disappointed us all.
Rutgers, they're the comeback kids. They were down 14-0 to Howard. They were down 21-0 to New Mexico. They come back and they win both of those games. I think that they're really turning the corner.
Nobody knows what to say in response to that.
He had 169 yards. You know, it's finally there's somebody other than Jenerian Grant to talk about.
Is there? Who is that?
Robert Martin can actually run the ball a little bit.
The guy that Rutgers Al believes is going to be a Heisman candidate. I can't tell if that is a serious account or not. Which is, I think,
the point. it's serious.
Is it?
It is definitely serious.
Well, we just wanted to get the cheap jokes in at Rutgers so we could move on again.
Yes.
Penn State 34, right. Temple 27 in a game where a ton of Penn State guys either couldn't play because of injuries or went out with injuries. Yeah. So, yep. You know, and they also muffed a punt on the 1 yard line or something, mm-hmm. And yes. Temple recovered. I think we have God's opinion on honoring Joe Paterno.
It's a no. Don't do that.
His opinion was, nah, let's not do that. So, right. I mean, relevant for Michigan mostly because this is a team that is going to be coming into Michigan Stadium next week. They look like they're going to be super banged up.
Yeah.
What was the yardage in this one? It's probably not as close as the score suggests.
Penn State 403, Temple 324.
So actually relatively close.
Yes.
I mean, if
they did completely shut down Temple's running game. Temple averaged 1.4 yards a carry.
Oof. So they got thrown on them.
They did get thrown 8.4 yards a pass for Temple.
That's
not looking good for them heading into next week.
Yeah, I don't really know what to do with that. And then, you know, Barkley just kind of pulls their butt out of the fire multiple times a game by making six different guys miss, which is something Michigan's going to have to like watch out for. But their offensive line just kind of seems like
and Barkley also was out for a decent chunk of this game.
He got
an ankle ding and was standing there with his helmet. He looked like he was kind of fine. He was running up and down the sideline. And he had his helmet on, and they weren't putting him back in. He only carried the ball 9 times in this.
Well, he did come back.
That was his first carry of the game that he went out on, and then we didn't see him again until the fourth quarter. And he iced the game with a pretty sweet 55-yard touchdown.
Yeah, he had a ridiculous touchdown run on that. It's Saquon Barkley.
Some guy missed, and then he outran three Temple DBs. Did kind of a kick step while he did it. It was pretty sweet. But when it comes to their Barkley and their run game, can I play the dangerous game of throwing out all the good runs? Like, I'll throw out three runs this year, a 28-yarder, a 29-yarder, and the 55-yarder that we just talked about. He has only 2.8 yards per carry on 48 attempts.
I think that is something that is relevant, right? Because
it's boom or bust for them.
Good. I'm always worried when I play this game, but I think I have a good track record of playing it fairly.
But it says something about what Penn State can do, which is not very much unless Barkley is going to do something ridiculous. We saw that in the game last year where Barkley ripped off a run that was not really spectacular on his part, but he ripped one off, and then he just couldn't do anything else the rest of the day. So,
because their offensive line is not very good. Still.
No, it's not. But Trace McSorley does look like an upgrade on Christian Hackenberg.
Yeah, both in terms of the throwing and the fact that he can actually evade pressure and make something out of it. He had a decent 13-yard scramble in this one where he got flushed out of the pocket and turned into a first down.
Yeah, they're averaging 9.2 yards per pass so far this year. That's 18th nationally, and they have 14 plays in the passing game of 20 or more yards. That's also in the top 20. With Hackenberg last year, they were middle of the pack as far as generating those type of big plays. Last week, they had 5 different guys catching balls of 24 yards or more, not average, at least one catch rather of 25 yards or more. Yesterday, they had 2 guys with a 52-yard catch and a 51-yard catch, and they had another guy with a 48-yard catch. So they're showing some consistent explosiveness in the passing game. I think the big question for them next week is, can the pass protection hold up? In last year's matchup, Taco Charlton and Chris Wormley completely dominated the tackle. Now, Paris Palmer's not playing tackle anymore for Penn State, and we don't know what Taco Charlton's status is, but Michigan does not just come at you with those two guys. And it's not like their tackle upgrade from Paris Palmer is that great. And so that's the key. You know, it'd be interesting if you look back at what your UFR numbers were on defensive ends, and probably close to mid-season highs.
I remember Hurst also had a really big game. Like he was coming off a tough Indiana game, and he just blew guys into the backfield. And this was, of course, without Ryan Glasgow. So this is Ryan Glasgow added to that defensive line performance from last year.
That's a good point. I forgot he was out of that game.
He was.
Talking about the Penn State players that were out, they were playing without 5 starters, and 4 others got hurt. And at one point, before the first ended, 7 starters on defense. All 3 linebackers basically didn't play yesterday. Their starting linebackers, Bell and Kabinda, didn't start. And then Niam Wartman-White, who's probably one of their best, he's probably their best guy in defense, who didn't play last year, he went out with a leg injury. So they played all game basically with their backup linebackers. Their middle linebacker right now is a walk-on.
Boy.
Don't honor Joe Paterno. That's we should be clear on this.
Not sure how many ways the universe can tell you this.
Yeah.
There's a message there.
So, I mean, despite the hiccups that Michigan had early in against the Colorado game, I'm not going into the Penn State game thinking that they're a good bet to upset Michigan. I like, what do you think this line is going to be?
Well, it was 14 points during the summer. Unfortunately, a lot of the sports books aren't updating their games of the year like they've done in the past. So I think it's still going to be a 2 touchdown by Vegas.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that feels right to me.
Yeah, like, home game for Michigan.
I think some of what we saw at Michigan, I think they'll tighten some of that stuff up. And I think that, to me, it felt like once Colorado, this going ahead to the, I felt like once Colorado got through with some of their early stuff, Michigan really settled down. And, you know, Penn State, you know, kind of like those early, very good under Rich Rod. You know, they could do one thing. You always wrote about this. They could do one thing, and then the other team would catch up with it, and they'd be, that's kind of what Penn State is.
Yeah, they'd have a new thing every game, and they'd do something good with it, and then it'd be over once they adapt.
Yeah.
So let's move on. I think we've talked about this game extensively. Michigan State 36, Notre Dame 28. We talked about the game theory bit where Notre Dame's down big and they just don't go for two early, even though they know they need one. So we can skip over that. You know, this game, you know, it has to be taken in the context of the Cal-Texas game.
Yeah.
Where Cal beats Texas 50-43. And now that early season classic between Texas and Notre Dame just looks like a battle of teams that don't have defenses. Especially
right. It looks like an Alamo Bowl.
Yeah, especially because, you know, Michigan State seals this game. Notre Dame's in a cover three and they have a guy run a go route and the safety just runs to the post. And the guy's just screamingly wide open. And of course, NBC cuts to unfrozen caveman defensive coordinator Brian Van Gorder, who just looks befuddled.
They also cut to Brian Kelly, who says some things like, cannot repeat if we want to avoid the explicit tag.
and of course, Notre Dame is leading this game 7-0 late in the second quarter when they have a dumb punt event where a punt that's just kind of rolling around goes off one of their own players who's trying to block. And then immediately on the subsequent play, Michigan State scores a touchdown because Notre Dame defensive back basically hands the ball to Donnie Corley. And they had a graphic up during this game about all the guys that they had left, they had exit the secondary. It was definitely a very never forget kind of graphic.
Yeah, it was all of them, basically.
And it showed. And I don't know how much of that is on Van Gorder, but there were just so many screamingly wide open plays, so many missed tackles. Like there were so many 4-yard plays that Michigan State had that they got to turn it into 20 because the cornerback didn't even slow down the receiver.
In the run game, Gerald Holmes had a 73-yard run right up the gut where I'm not sure he was touched.
He wasn't, and that was like one of the defensive ends just getting crushed, like absolutely pancaked, blown over, and then Holmes makes a nice cut, and it's just like,
there's nobody home.
I didn't expect this to happen because I just assumed that the Texas Notre Dame game was between two good teams, and no.
Not so sure.
Not really so sure.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I think unofficially, Mark D'Antonio is now 63-0 in, you know, moments where everybody writes the Spartans off.
Now, can we start taking over?
It's ridiculous. That needs to actually become one of my new, like, betting rules. Like, wait, what? Nobody thinks Michigan State has a shot? Oh, okay. I mean, I can't explain it.
I do think we need
to win as the Michigan State head coach straight up as an underdog. And they've now won 10 of their last 13 games against ranked opponents. 6 of those last 7 games have been away from Spartan Stadium. So, you know, they have a formula and it works. And, you know, we were talking about how Texas and Notre Dame just sort of look like a game maybe between average teams. And never more was that evident, you know, in the trenches last night. I mean, Michigan State's offensive front just leaned on them all night. And it was a steady dose of Holmes and Scott. They both, I think, both went over 100 yards. No, one only had 98. So they didn't really do anything spectacular other than just hand the ball off a lot. 52 carries last night for Michigan State.
I do think we need to take over as often the coordinator for every team that plays Michigan State and call 4 verts until it doesn't work.
I mean, that was the thing. They get down like 36-7, and then they just throw the ball downfield over and over again. And surprise.
That works.
It works. I don't understand.
At one point last night, Notre Dame was averaging 7.1 yards per play, but they were down 22.
Yeah, I mean, it's I didn't expect it to go this way, and I think that Michigan State is obviously better than I thought. But
one thing that's worth pointing out is, you know, I was reading PFF before we got on here, and, you know, that Michigan State preview that we've all talked about, you know, how will they replace, you know, their great players. Remember, focused on kind of how subpar their linebacking play was last year, with his tackles, et cetera, et cetera. Their breakdown of the game last night basically gave, you know, their top billing to their linebacking unit as a whole, and their top star of the game was Reschke. And I definitely remember, without even needing to read their recap, I definitely remember Reschke having a great tackle for loss in the run play and then having an interception on the very next play, you know. And so, you know, maybe that unit's stepped up compared to how they played last year. I didn't really see a lot of pass rush. You know, I think they only had like one or two sacks. They really kept Kaiser clean that whole second half. That kind of allowed for that comeback. That was another sort of flaw that preview brought up. But they seem to be on board with their linebackers now. So great. It's back to having great.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see on that. They, their issues last year weren't as much about being in the right place as it was about missing tackles once they got there. So yeah. We'll see if that continues.
Yeah, I just wonder if...
an interesting game this Saturday against Wisconsin up in East Lansing.
How good is Furman, though?
That's the real question.
They're 0-3. I made some joke about I should bet on them for the FCS title, and a lot of people mentioned they were 0-3. I'm still making.
And finally this week, Ohio State 45, Oklahoma 24. This was 42-17 early in the third quarter and could have been much worse. And then Urban Meyer was just like, let's run the ball and get out of here. And I think it's official that Ohio State has reloaded.
They are scary. Yeah.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. I don't really know what else to say.
Yeah.
I wish that they were not as good at football as they are, but here we are.
Curtis Samuel is going to be a problem, obviously. I was reading a breakdown on him earlier in the week. They basically use him 50-50 in the slot or at running back. Pretty effective.
I think he has almost the exact same amount of
yardage.
Oklahoma,
though, last night, they really shot themselves in the foot. They could have stayed in this game. Their first four drives, they averaged over 6 yards per play, but they only got 3 points. They kicked a field goal, obviously 3 points. They doinked the short field goal off the crossbar or off the goalpost rather, and then they had a pick six on fourth and three, pretty fairly deep in OSU's territory. They got a kickoff return for a touchdown in the middle of that, so they sort of got, you know, made up for that a little bit. But you know, I felt all week that this was going to be a shootout, and Oklahoma just couldn't put points on the board early, and you know, obviously you can't. It's really hard to play on Ohio State. And then those two touchdowns at the end of the first half, especially that touchdown catch, holy moly.
And Noah Brown, not bad.
Yeah, Noah Brown, yeah. That game was over at halftime, like you said, Brian. They didn't need to score any more points in the second half. They just needed to get the game over.
Yep, so that's lame.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Yeah. Agreed. The one thing I wish Oklahoma would have done was use Joe Mixon. For some reason, they were just smashing Samaje Perine into the line for like 3.5 yards a carry. They gave him twice as many carries as Mixon, and Mixon ends up averaging 8.7 yard carry.
Yeah. That happens a lot in Oklahoma games, especially when they're on their losing end. It's either they don't use both of them or they don't use one of them. And, you know, and yeah, Mixon was totally rolling. He was the one who had the kickoff return for a touchdown.
Yeah, he looked great.
You know, yeah.
Except he dropped the ball before he got in the end zone.
He did.
Stop doing this, people!
Right. I don't understand why that's such a problem.
I forgot about that.
They dodged a bullet there. Wow. The officials in that game were not super impressive.
Well, apparently, if nobody jumps on it, it's just their ball at the one anyway. So it's like it doesn't even matter, which angers me.
That's interesting.
You think there should be more of a punishment for being that stupid?
I think anybody who does that should be like bent over and spanked by their coach at the 50. Like that should be the penalty for that. Like they'll get like an official paddle. You don't believe in corporal punishment, Ace, I can tell. But this is a situation that I think deserves corporal punishment.
I mean, football's a pretty darn violent game, so if there's ever a time for it, I guess it might be that.
Don't drop the football before you go on the end zone, you
I think that's
gutses.
The lesson here.
Never.
Well, this happened in the Texas game, and they just gave it to Cal on the 1 yard line because nobody jumped on it, which is stupid.
Yeah, Cal's got a history of that. But they kind of started it.
DeSean Jackson.
Although DeSean Jackson started it in the Army All-American game.
Well, did you guys see what happened in the Clemson South Carolina State game? Speaking of like,
Neil won a touchback, kid.
Corporal punishment. For
my goodness. No, his punishment was immediate. That was a touchdown.
Partially running out of the end zone and changing their mind. I think like all those three and probably maybe even one or two more situations that I can't think of should fall under Brian's corporal punishment strategy, because those things seem to be happening too often, and they're just...
I'd say the South Carolina State one was properly...
They need to be disciplined out of their system.
Indeed. All right, Jamie, we're out of time, so we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the MGO podcast. I am Ace Ambender along with Brian Cook, and I am dead serious about the standing offer to call plays against Michigan State. It will be four verticals every time until further notice, but it will work. It really will work.